So, it's 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. And as always, at 5 o'clock on Tuesday, it's time for Office Hour. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And before we begin, we got to remind you that the views that are expressed in the show do not reflect or may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. And I'm very pleased to be here. It was fun to be on vacation, but it's great to be back here again and knocking on people's doors. There's so many interesting things going on in this campus and so many interesting people to talk to. And today we're going to a slightly different part of the campus as our first in a series that I'm going to be doing on and off during the fall. Because some people on this campus, when they have more than one door you can knock on. People on campus have multiple tasks and multiple roles. And we're starting with somebody who has two roles today. And we'll do the best we can to get through all of the roles. And if not, we'll have her back to talk about the next roles. So we're going to start off here with welcoming to our show, Ashley Theodorsen Taggart. So welcome, Ashley.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Okay, now Ashley has two hats. For one, she is a graduate student in performance study. So we're going to talk about performance studies and her graduate research. But she also is a former director of the Women's Resource Center. And if we have time, we don't get too waylaid by her fascinating research, we're going to talk a little bit about the Women's Center, because I'm sure there are many people on campus and many people in the listening audience who are not really sure what is a Women's Resource Center. So so you can Google it on your Wikipedia while you're while you're getting ready. In the meantime, we always start off as the show with the same question, which is we try to find out how people become interested in their areas of research. And this is very interesting for me because the topic we're going to be talking about with her is birth and images of birthing in America. So I imagine that every single listener out there shares something in common, which is that everybody listening today has been born.
True.
Right.
Yeah.
So everybody has been born. And up to now, everybody's been born from a woman. Right.
Well, it depends on how we define woman.
Okay.
But yes, everyone's been born.
Right.
Yeah.
And we don't have the, except for the people like to point out to me, the Kindergarten Cop movie in which Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? Or something. Or,
I think you're right. I think we've got some more complicated sort of depictions
right.
of pregnancy
exactly.
and birth out there. Some more accurate than others.
So what might happen today is you may end up calling your mother, if you can. My mother, unfortunately, has passed away. I would certainly be very interested to call her and talk about some of the things we're going to be talking about today. Imagery. She grew up in South Dakota, and there were very few doctors. As a matter of fact, she said they really didn't have a doctor. They had a chiropractor who would come around occasionally. And but other than that, when she got to the University of Chicago to do her MA, she had never had a vaccination of any type. She, you know, grew up in that kind of a world. So every birth was a home birth.
Yeah.
Because that's what it was. So, but let's let Ashley now tell us about how she became interested in researching images of birthing as a performance studies graduate student.
Sure. Well, that's kind of a long story, and it really does go back to, you know, it really goes back to when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say about 18 years ago, and I was a sophomore in high school, and I grew up in a really rural community, very small town, Northern California. Maybe 12,000 people at the time. Big high school, though. So about 2,000 kids at the high school. And one of the things, you know, that I realized relatively early on as I was looking around at my high school campus and I was seeing these, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old students, you know, peers of mine who were becoming parents. And so I started thinking about what our community resources looked like around sexual and reproductive health. And really, there was only one community health clinic in the entire town. And the primary physician at that health clinic was the father of a peer. So it was a friend's father. And although I think he was a great physician, you know, we really did lack that sort of truly confidential resource around sexual and reproductive health care. So there were major issues in the community with getting information about sexually transmitted infections, birth control, you know, where to go to get screening, what to do if you had questions, where to go if you wanted a termination. These were all really up in the air. And at that time, it wasn't like, for example, today when you can really just Google. You can Google it. You can figure out where is the nearest area. And we were a good hour away from any sort of major city. So very rural and really under-resourced. And so from a very early age, I realized that, hey, this is a big problem. Because I think that, you know, had you asked a lot of those folks who are becoming parents in their early teens, you know, would you have done something else if you had had other options? I think a number of them might have said, yeah, maybe, yeah. You know, so it really started then. And I kind of took those concerns with me to university when I went away for my undergraduate studies. And at the time I was studying sociology and sexuality studies. And I was really looking at sexually transmitted infection rates and prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So my focus at that time was less on birth and much more on STI prevention and so forth. And so, you know, I kind of did volunteer work throughout my undergraduate years around these topics and certainly wrote about them and researched them and studied them. And it wasn't until my last year as an undergraduate when I had the opportunity to do a capstone project. And I decided to look at HIV/AIDS transmission rates in this very particular, you know, because I had received funding to do a very particular kind of research project. So I was looking at a very particular region in Kenya that had a very high rate of maternal fetal transmission of HIV/AIDS. And it was really the first time that I looked at the birth scene at all, you know, after let's say, you know, at that point, 7 years of doing sexual and reproductive justice work, research, activism, so forth. I hadn't really considered birth as part of that. And so I started looking at how birth happened around the world and who were the figures who were involved with birth. And I kept finding this sort of mysterious figure, but it seemed to be pretty consistent across cultures and across time, of this sort of generally older maternal relative friend, so forth, who was present in the birth space and was there as a support person. I didn't have a name for it. I had never really heard about it. I hadn't really cared about birth too much. And so I started researching, you know, whether we had that figure in contemporary Western birthing. And it turns out we do. And I have a word for it now, but I didn't at the time. So we would call that figure the birth doula.
Right
now. But, you know, this is sort of a new agey term for a kind of an ancient profession, right?
A lot of women were doulas, didn't know the term.
That's right. That's right.
They were just there.
Exactly. And like I said, historically, it was really, you know, that role was filled by a mother or a grandmother or an aunt or a friend. And so that was really the first time that I had come across this particular figure. And I thought it was really intriguing. You know, having been familiar at least with some of the statistics around birth outcomes, maternal and fetal outcomes, I thought, okay, this is interesting. I wonder what's happening here. So I graduate and I go on to find a job at sort of an alternative health center locally. And shortly thereafter, you know, within 7 months of graduating, I had my first child. So I was 22. And had just given birth. And I thought to myself, okay, that was an experience.
I've been studying this theoretically for a long time. Suddenly the other shoe is dropped.
That's right. And so I really felt like at that point, I wanted to become trained as a birth doula. And I went through that process. So it took me about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And I studied with an organization called DONA, which is Doulas of North America. And I got my birth doula certification through them. I worked with another group called La Leche League, which goes back.
It's well known.
Well known, yeah. And became a breastfeeding counselor. Mm-hmm. And I also was trained to teach prenatal and postpartum education classes. So I spent the next 8 years or so working, you know, combination of a private practice as a birth doula and also working with local nonprofits in the Central Valley.
So how many births do you think you attended?
Oh, gosh, I get asked this question all the time. I don't know. I wish I had a count on it. But I think between my work as a private doula and as a volunteer working with these nonprofits, I don't know, 100, 200.
Mm-hmm. A lot.
Yeah. And it's interesting work because it's very much on call. So traditionally, the birth doula will meet with a pregnant person two or three times in the prenatal period. And then be there providing continuous support during the labor and birth process, and then meet a few times, at least twice, in the postpartum period to talk about things like breastfeeding and infant care, these things that seem like they ought to be intuitive. Mm-hmm. But when you're confronted with this tiny little human that you're supposed to take care of, especially for the first time, they're they can be perplexing.
But, you know, if you think about it, your story has two very different parts. One is the traditional older woman.
Yeah.
And one is the kind of like, what do we do? Maybe it says something about our society that we have to manufacture traditional old women.
Sure, sure. Oh, I think it does, for sure.
Right.
And I think that it says, you know, it says a ton about how we do birth now. Mm-hmm. And who has been excluded from those spaces. And I think that we can ask some interesting questions about, okay, well, what's happened, you know, in this country when we really lost that sort of traditional maternal lineage in the birth space?
Mm-hmm.
So when we no longer had mothers and aunts and friends and grandmothers in the birth space, what was lost there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we just have now, for the most part, medical professionals.
Mm-hmm.
And a laboring person, mm-hmm. and maybe they have a partner or someone that's with them. But
so then what led you from there into performance studies?
Yeah.
Because performance, and I'm sure that if you ask 10 people about what performance study is, you will get not 10, you'll get 12 answers is what I found in my little foray into
true.
That there's a lot of, so one could say generally derivative from presentational arts, from theater, with the idea of cultural space in which one can question a lot of cultural presuppositions through a sort of an amalgam of different kinds of arts processes. How did I do?
Yeah, I think that's pretty good.
Okay.
I think that's pretty good. You get a pass.
Okay.
yeah, so the story from there is interesting. So I did this work as a doula for a long time, and then I decided that I wanted to come back to the academy.
Mm.
So that's when I came back to the Women's Center, and I was there for 5 years. And, you know, when you work in a sort of community resource position like that, you wear all kinds of hats. And so there was a lot of crisis work. There was a lot of policy advocacy across campus. There's a lot of gender equity related programming. And working with undergraduate and graduate students. And all of that sort of got me back into researching and writing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the many wonderful things about having a job at the Women's Center was that I had funding. I had research funding. So I could be researching and writing and traveling to present my research at conferences. And so I sort of started getting those connections back with other people who were doing similar or related research, and started having, you know, just more interesting conversations about what's happening with birth. And that's really when I started thinking seriously about the impact of media, like media portrayals of the labor and birth experience on lived experiences of birth. And so that was really the direction that my research took at that point, looking really at the sort of relationship between sexual and reproductive experiences and the media.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. You think the media is pretty influential in America and everything else. So in some ways, I think it's probably not too surprising for our listeners that the media also influences. And maybe they want to just close their eyes and think for a minute about some of the images of birthing they might have run into in the media. It's funny, I was just interviewed this afternoon by a student of mine who is, though being a religious studies major, is in doula training herself, and she needed to interview someone who'd had a baby.
Yeah.
So just by coincidentally, and we were talking about some of the images in our minds around birth. So you decided you needed to actually really to study these in a more, this is a warning out there. You start to get interested in these things. The next thing, listeners, you end up getting a PhD.
That's right. You find yourself in a graduate program. That's right. Yeah. And that's really how it happened. You know, I was having all of these interesting conversations and I was researching, you know, through the Women's Center. But you know, it can be difficult to talk about these sorts of things in the academy. I think for a long time, questions around birth and the maternal have been relegated to like bad mommy academia, and they haven't been part of mainstream academic discourse, or they haven't been, you know, sort of validated in those spaces. Not that the scholarship and the sort of level of intellect in the conversation hasn't been there; it has been for you know decades. But there hasn't been a ton of space in academia for those kinds of conversations, you know, from my perspective, at least in my experience.
Right.
And
you have a very particular perspective. I mean, I know many people who work at, for example, UCSF, where they do a lot of work around women's reproductive health from this sort of that end. But you're not really talking about that end. You're really talking about how do we as Americans imagine and think about birth? Where do we get our images from?
Yeah.
What kinds of ideas do we have in our mind?
Yeah,
in that case, performance studies does make a certain kind of sense, and it's a place you can ask those types of questions.
Absolutely. You know, so for me, performance studies was a natural fit. It's a really unique PhD program in that you know, if you looked across, if you looked at all the students who were in the program, you would see people doing work in all kinds of different sort of genres. So you would see dancers and choreographers and actors. Those are kinds of things that you might expect, right, to be researched in a program like this. But you're also going to see people who are, for example, there's someone in our program who's a tight wire walker.
Mm-hmm.
There's someone in our program who's a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, my research on birth. And I think that one of the things that's great about the program is that it is so interdisciplinary.
Okay.
It's also one of the challenges of mm-hmm. the program. It's very interdisciplinary, and you can really go, you can ask all kinds of questions,
mm-hmm.
but you really have to pull together the resources to kind of figure out how you're going to answer those questions.
So the question that you bring then to this, potpourri of approaches there is, as we've said, the images of birth. And I was struck by one of the things you'd written, that you said that you think there are few areas in which the inadequacy of representation is felt more profoundly than in this area.
Yeah.
That birth is, oddly enough, something that we have a very sort of monochromatic or monosyllabic way of thinking about in terms of representation.
Yeah.
And I found that was a very striking idea, and I've been thinking about that, wondering, first of all, how did we come to be that? How did it come that birthing has one type of image?
Sure.
And it seems to me, from what you've been writing, that it's sort of the juxtaposition of two American trends. One is the hospitalization of everything. So, yep. Birth is now takes place within the hospital. So it's associated with everything with hospitals.
Sure.
And the other one is, because you're talking about a TV show, mm-hmm. that it's also just sort of the way in which media in general mm-hmm. Sometimes has a narrow spectrum of representation of something. So
sure.
those two together have given us sort of the primary model of birth then would be a woman giving birth in a TV show in a hospital.
Yep. Yeah. And if we think about if we think about the images we've seen of birth on television shows or in movies, how is the person giving birth generally situated? Lying flat on their back on a gurney, right? In a hospital, for sure, with a medical doctor. And generally, it's it's portrayed as a very scary experience, a frightening experience that is an emergency, right?
Yes.
You go to the hospital when you're sick. You don't go to the hospital when you're just having a normal experience. Now we go to the hospital for birth all the time. So I think that, this sort of combination of things creates a particular kind of image of birth, which then, allows us to sort of create this expectation that's based not on other births we've seen, for example.
But on this model.
On this model, yeah.
That takes over. So you talk in particular, I was very, I'd never seen this show, but I thought it was quite interesting, the show that there's some documentary, there's some reality TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
One is called A Baby Story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the other one is called Bringing Home Baby.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about what you, in case some of our listeners have never seen these shows, so they may want to run out and watch them now. What kind of depictions do we have on these reality TV shows about birth?
So these, the two shows that you mentioned are older shows that started really in the 90s and went into the 2000s.
Hmm.
And they aired on networks like Lifetime, these television for women sorts of channels. And I look in particular at another show called One Born Every Minute,
which
follows in the footsteps of these other shows. And so it was originally conceived of as an hour-long British observational documentary. That's what they called it, British observational documentary. I mean, in reality, it's a reality television show. That's what it is.
So it was originally conceived of as just being one show.
Yeah. Well, it was a series, but it was kind of put forth as this documentary. Like you're
uh-huh.
really seeing these births caught on camera.
I see. And unlike the reality TV Baby Story and Bringing Home Baby, this one was going to give us the scientific real story.
That's right. And when I talk about this show, I kind of liken the footage that they shoot of the births. So let me back up. So this show debuted in 2010. On I think the Channel 4 network in the UK. And then a year later it debuted in the United States. So what they found is huge viewer ratings.
Hmm.
Huge viewer ratings. No one had seen this sort of like caught on camera birth experience before. So since 2010, it's been also produced in the U.S., as I said, France, Sweden, and Israel. At least that many countries, and then there may be more. But they, you know, for their most viewed episodes, many, many millions of viewers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the show starts off the same way every single time. So you kind of, Jamie Lee Curtis, the actor, is the sort of opening narrator. And so, you know, the show opens and you hear her voice as a voiceover, you know, over these sirens and the screams and these flashing lights. And they say, you know, this is Riverside Methodist Hospital and you're about to see real life caught on camera.
And they always go by ambulance?
Well, it makes it seem as though everything is an absolute emergency. So you see all of these machines around that are flashing lights and beeping, and there's all this chart paper flying out of them. And, you know, so you really feel like, okay, all right, this is going to be intense. You know, you don't feel good about it necessarily. Yeah. You don't feel like this is going to be a real picnic in the park, you know? And so then from there, the show will kind of introduce three sets of expectant couples. And they kind of talk through a little bit of their backstory, who they are, what they do. Vast majority of the time, they are white folks.
And they're presumably paid for this.
I don't know that they're paid. They're usually given a stipend of some sort, but that could be like travel and accommodations. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, I don't think they're compensated significantly for what they do. But, you know, there's very little representation of same-sex couples, very little representation of non-white bodies, no trans families, you know. So, which is basically what you would expect, I guess, for a mainstream show that's dealing with birth, which I think is generally conceived of as like a heterosexual venture, you know. So then from there, they kind of flash back and forth between what they call actual real-life caught-on-camera footage and these prenatal interviews. They also talk to the hospital staff. And so, so again, it's an hour-long show, and they just kind of go back and forth, and that's the format. And one thing that strikes me when I watch this program is that the mothers that come in are really, they fit into very few categories, maybe 2 to 3 categories of kind of experience. And none of them feel particularly empowering for the mothers.
Right.
You know, so this stands out to me. Of course. And, you know, the whole thing is really caught, you know, they film it like it's super exciting and it's an emergency. And that is, of course, how we get viewer ratings. Now, is that true about the birth experience all the time? Well, you know, as someone who's attended a lot of births, I can tell you the vast majority of labors are pretty boring for the majority of the time. You know, things get interesting at the end, but, you know, for the most part, you're kind of, you know, letting the body do its thing, and it's not that exciting.
And maybe complaining.
And maybe you may be complaining.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of. I can't imagine that there's that some of that would be very interesting for other people to watch. I think that, you know, for my time in the hospital, there were very few minutes of a lot of activity and a lot of just sort of complaining up until that moment, because I was just really ready to have those babies all the time. But so why do you think these couples do it?
I think, number one, they're generally reflect on their birth experiences as like, well, you know, that was tough, but it's the way it is. So I think that there sort of can be like a pride element of like, you know, I really want to wear my badge of like, I had this horrible birth experience.
Right.
I did it. And I think there are some people that really just genuinely want to share that feel like, hey, this isn't a bad thing. We're really showing what this experience was like for us. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's some truth to that, too.
Mm-hmm. And media attention is media attention.
Yeah.
Even if you can't speak calm sentences to the camera.
Right. That's right.
You're flailing around. It's still a kind of media attention.
That's right.
Uh-huh. So so in addition to saying that these women don't have a lot of they have a very scripted role.
Sure.
I think one of the things you're talking about is birth is a very scripted activity.
Sure.
You also talk about sort of characterizing that the shows present sort of types of women, which is not too surprising because I'm sure that they're trying to digest the material for the viewers.
Sure.
And so you talk about three different kinds of mothers who are presented on the show.
Mm-hmm.
The first one you mentioned is the trope of the challenging mother.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a mother who wants to do things her own way.
Mm-hmm.
And are you saying that the show often presents sort of as a negative spin on these women, that it's not so good for women to have too many opinions?
I think that that's a fair way to say it. I think that in general, when you're going into a hospital for any reason, whether it's to give birth or because you've got a broken bone, there are certain sets of policies and protocols that really govern your treatment. You know, if A happens, then B has to happen. If B happens, then C has to happen within 24 hours and so on and so forth. And so I think there can sometimes be this perception, or at least this is what we see in the show, that the medical staff feels kind of inconvenienced by a person who comes in and says, hey, I really want this, or I really don't want that. That feels like, okay, now you're kind of messing up our system. And, you know, that makes it difficult, makes it more difficult for them to do their jobs because it's less formulaic. And, you know, again, these are sort of crude categories that I've identified, but I think that they hold. And so the trope that I identify as like the trope of the challenging mother is really about a woman who comes in and just has preferences, you know.
I think there's a lot. I mean, it's a long time ago now. My younger son is 25, so it's not exactly a recent birth. But there is, I think, is a very important point that I would like to reiterate for our listeners. I'd be very curious, the women listeners who have had experiences giving birth in hospitals. It is, you do kind of get into the, you know, you do what they tell you to do. In my case, my son was very small, and I kept trying to tell everybody in the hospital, look at my husband. You know, we're just, we're a small family, but they were sort of in crisis mode over the crisis of the small baby. Now, it turns out it's a totally fine baby, and I had a totally fine birth, and it was all completely normal. But within the spectrum for them, since babies are generally getting bigger in America, a perfectly normal small baby with two small parents, you know, it somehow put us into some kind of worry, worrisome mode. And I think it took over and led to a lot of protocols that didn't turn out to be very necessary or helpful for us.
And you know, I think that's a really interesting, you know, story that you're sharing. And I think that we hear this a lot as birth workers, right? That like, everything turned out fine, but everyone was really worried. And in the process, there were a lot of things that were sort of put in place that potentially made it more complicated than it had to be. Which is not to say, you know, I think that it's important to note that, you know, when it comes to birth, there are a number of different options for people. There are home births with licensed midwives. There are birth center births that could be with a midwife or an OB. There are hospital births that could be with a midwife or an OB. So there are all of these different options, and there's no one right option, right? But it is about sort of understanding the multiplicity, you know, that it's not just, oh, this is what I have to do because this is how it's done. You know, there are options, there are choices. And the choice that's right for one person may be completely different than the choice that's right for the next.
Well, I think that may be more open in the last while. I think that when I had my two sons, and we're even talking about living in Berkeley. Nobody really in my circles pushed home birth. It was a little bit before that, the idea of being in the hospital. And it's easy to frighten a pregnant woman. Know, you say, and I certainly would always tell everybody that I'm really glad I was giving birth now and not 100 years ago or 100 years ago, because women die in childbirth, and I was just really glad that I was five blocks away in case something happened. But I think maybe that's the key to this part of the discussion, which is that choice sometimes seems to be make someone be challenging. Just having choice sometimes gets oneself then characterized in a sort of a negative kind of way.
I think so. I think very much. I think that's very much the case. And, you know, God forbid you plan to have a home birth and then you decide, you know, during the middle of your labor, I think it'd be better to be in a hospital because, my gosh, then you're definitely categorized as a challenging mother who's not going to go along with things, you know. And in reality, you may just have decided, this was the right choice for me, and now there's another right choice, you know.
Well, we've already reached the end of the first segment here on Office Hour today. So we are going to take a break, and then we will be back after a couple announcements with Ashley Tedorsen. Taggart, long name.
That's a long
name. And to talk some more about what other kinds of mothers do you think the TV shows present to us besides what we've already decided, which is the challenging mother. So stay tuned for that, and we will be right back. So welcome back to the second half of Office Hour today. This is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and we're talking today about the images of birth that dominate in American society and partly shaped by media. and partly shaped by these kinds of TV shows that go and show actual births and then kind of categorize them for us and therefore organize in people's minds how it is that birth takes place. And we were talking about the different kinds of mothers that these shows present. And Ashley was saying that one type is the challenging mother. And we talked that that's sort of the mother that has an opinion as opposed to just going along with hospital protocol. And I certainly would say hospital protocol is important. It's just sometimes not necessary for birth, you know.
Sure.
You know. So then the next type is the trope of the lucky mother.
Mm-hmm.
So the lucky mother is somebody who just sort of has a simple delivery.
Sure. So the way I talk about this trope in relation to one born every minute is these are the mothers that come in and they have either a precipitous birth, so it's quick,
mm-hmm.
An uncomplicated birth, or what they often describe as an easy birth.
Mm.
And you know, in some cases, this just means that they show up and nothing goes wrong and they don't have time to intervene in any particular way. So birth unfolds as it unfolds. But one thing that is, for me, troubling about the way this kind of mother is characterized in the show is that she's never given credit for her hard work or for timing her arrival at the hospital, you know, well. It's always just dumb luck.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I think that's a very important point because luck kind of takes out, has a sort of, in our society, a very randomized, out-of-control notion.
Yeah.
I feel very ambivalent about this category, frankly, because I think I was a lucky mother.
Uh-huh.
So I'm trying to feel, how do I feel about that?
Sure.
You know, do I feel, you know, that I got it, as I said, as I was telling you before the show, that my husband was worried about how long that we'd be able to park in the neighborhood of the hospital. So I got in and got out before we got a ticket.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
So is that luck or is that just, I was just, I'm sure some of it was luck, frankly,
well, you know,
in the sense that I was just, you know, some... nothing, no complications
sure.
happened to occur. And the second one was also so very fast. But I think the question of that the category does kind of, like so much of what we're talking about today, it does kind of take away the agency of the mother, that the mother is kind of just, it's sort of like what's behind door one.
Yep. Yeah. Well, exactly. I totally agree. I think that, you know, this is what I've always said about birth. Birth is like life. You can have a plan. It can go according to the plan. You can change the plan. Something can pop up that you didn't expect. But birth isn't any different than actual life. So sometimes it's going to unfold in a way that you feel really happy with. Sometimes you're going to feel like, oh, man, I wish that was different or I wish I hadn't done mm-hmm. that. But in any case, you know, it is often a profoundly meaningful experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and I think that we really have to trouble any sort of language that we're using around birth when we say that was an easy birth or that's a lucky mom. I really think we have to think, you know, very carefully about that sort of.
Okay. And the third one is the trope of the mother who is saved.
Yeah.
And you say that this is the most common portrayal of the mother
mm-hmm.
is that the presumably primarily male medical establishment mm-hmm. saves the woman.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is what we see the vast majority of the time in the show. Which is mom shows up, she's in labor, usually early in labor, you know, and she gets into the hospital room and she gets her IV put in and she gets her, you know, fetal monitoring done and she's usually lying on her back. She's usually given an epidural and, you know, whatever the sort of cascade of interventions are, they kind of happen one on top of the next. And I think, you know, in terms of intervention rates, it's interesting to look at intervention rates. It's not my particular interest in terms of this research, but I think we can look at how one intervention often invites the next and mm-hmm. the next and the next. And before we know it, we've got a doctor running into the room, you know, to catch that baby. And in the very end, you know, after what can sometimes be a harrowing experience, we say, oh, thank God, the doctor mm-hmm. was there.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness. What would have happened otherwise?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in those moments, perhaps, you know, perhaps a doctor is the one who really helped out. We're really, really happy to have doctors there in the birth room when we need them.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, but again, I think this question that you brought up of agency and feeling of agency is really pretty central to any of these three tropes. You know, in that case, we're locating the agency and the success with the physician.
Mm-hmm.
Not with the person who's just given birth.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's basically a hospital show.
Yeah.
It has to fit in those kinds of things. Yeah. So, I mean, there are two questions that that I'm thinking about based on our discussion so far. One of them is, and they're two pretty big questions, so I don't know which order we'll take them in. One of them is, how do we change the imagery of birthing in American society? Uh-huh. I suppose that we don't know this answer yet because you haven't finished your PhD.
That's right. I'll report back in a couple of years. But one thing I will say, which I think is relevant to the question, is that in the last couple of years, there have been some really interesting policy changes that have happened on two major social media platforms, Facebook and Instagram, who are owned by the same company. So prior to about 2 years ago, you couldn't show any videos or images of human birth on either platform.
They were taken down.
It was considered pornographic.
Pornographic.
Explicit content there. And then about 2 years ago, they made a major policy shift on both platforms that they then decided to allow photos and video of human birth. And so I think when we're trying to think about how do we create or cultivate a more sort of comprehensive portrayal of birth, you know, one kind of interesting piece that I think is worth researching more and looking into is, how has the circulation of images and videos of normal birth really changed since these two platforms have begun allowing them? And I think that's a question. You know, I don't have the answer, but I think it's an interesting question.
Okay, so to our first question about how does this change, one of the, I think it's somewhat, obvious answer is that you have more media doing it in different ways.
Sure.
And what you're particularly pointing to is media that is related to the individual families and the individual experiences.
Yeah.
So you're not going to get it set up by some TV producer. It's just going to be raw people presenting their births.
Sure.
And that's going to give a much wider, as much as Facebook is used by different groups, a wider sort of venue into that.
Well, I wonder about that. But I think that there are other things that are happening too. I've got a good friend who's a midwife who works out of Sacramento. She has the only out-of-hospital birth center in the entire county of Sacramento that accepts Medi-Cal patients. It's called Welcome Home Midwifery Service. And she has just started a podcast. So I think that this is another way. It's like we're having frank conversations in sort of interesting ways about what actual birth looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's sort of another area of resistance. And again, it's not happening in mainstream media, but it is happening. And I think that we are hearing, sort of a broader range of stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that's particularly important given the fact that you write about, and we haven't really discussed it yet, but I've heard in numerous different settings, the problems with the infant mortality and problems with women of color, that they are not being served and the way that they should be in America.
Absolutely.
So the idea that, so that's very interesting. The second question, which may turn out to be harder, is how this fits in general. You're sort of talking about the control of imagery, the control of women, how this fits in with the more general question of the control of imagery of women and women's bodies, which is obviously something that's on everybody's minds these days.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's so much going on nationally around controlling women's bodies by people outside of women's bodies.
Yeah.
And also through this sort of where healthcare and abortion rights sort of merge together. So you touch on that only briefly, but you've had a lot of experience with this, and I'd be curious how you see the two overlapping.
I think that there are a number of interesting sort of layers to this question. So I think that I'm thinking in particular right now about just the different layers of control over particularly women's bodies and particularly over their sexual and reproductive health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm thinking about sort of what's happening nationally. So what's happening on the Supreme Court and what's happening with sort of federal funding, right, for abortion services, for sexual and reproductive health care, and so forth. I'm thinking about state policies, which, you know, what we've seen since Trump has taken office is about a 63% increase in anti-abortion legislation across the states at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think we have to think about the federal policy, we have to think about the state policy, and then because the vast majority of people in this country are giving birth in hospitals, we really have to think carefully about the role of not just the medical institutions, but also big pharma and big drug companies, you know. So I think that it's a very complicated question. And that's sort of just like a first layer, because I think that really in order to understand the extent to which women's bodies are being controlled in this way, we have to also think about this issue that we're talking about today, which is media representation. Because the bottom line is the vast majority of people who give birth in this country have never seen or attended another live birth before giving birth themselves. So really the only way that we have to formulate our expectations about what this experience is going to be like come from what we've seen on TV and in movies and now perhaps on social media. So, you know, I think we really can't overestimate the extent to which, you know, these sorts of media representations are significantly impacting and shaping what how we formulate our expectations of birth.
Right. So I think that's a very important point, and it's a subtle point. So I want to reinforce it for our listeners. I just want to go over it again, that we wouldn't necessarily think about abortion rights issues being fought out on TV shows. But it is the way in which the TV shows about birth, but it is the way in which these shows show you women as subjected to the controls of the medical establishment, the way in which they are become part of these larger social agendas, the way in which the women need to be saved, the way in which you don't want to deal with women who have too many opinions about anything, the vulnerability around sexuality and around reproduction, and the heroic effort to save women and all of that stuff. I mean, it's quite striking to me because it's also quite striking to me that you haven't talked much in these shows about the fathers. I mean, maybe they may appear a little bit in there, but it's the same way in which in abortion, the role of the men is so incredibly elided. It's like it doesn't even exist.
It's erased. It really does.
It's completely gone. So we sort of also have this almost, and, you know, I don't know how analytic we and provocative or theoretical we want to get, but it does seem to me that it ties in quite deeply with things that people like Karen Horn and I wrote about, which is a very visceral concern about women. You know, both, you know, that women are so necessary for society because you need them to for a lot of important things. But there's also something that is somewhat terrifying, even about one's own mother and the fear of the female, and that we're dealing with things that are quite, you know, maybe, again, not talked about enough. And then we're trying, we're seeing how they're trying to be organized by the media instead. And that has a big effect on how it organizes our psyche.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. And, you know, I think that it's really important that you brought up the role of the partner, who is usually a father in these shows, because just like we talked about these tropes that emerge of mothers, there are also, there's really only one trope about fathers in the show, which is that they're not that smart. And they have no idea what's going on. And they certainly can't help. They're just in the way. And, you know, I feel like in the show, the primary reason that they even interview or show the fathers at all is because, you know, they want to catch them doing something stupid, like dropping the camera, the phone on the baby when they're trying to take a picture of it, or tripping over something, or eating chips loudly in the corner of the delivery room. You know, so it's pretty much universally a not appealing representation of these fathers. And ironically, as a birth doula, you would think that, you know, 90% of the work that you did would be supporting the person who's in labor. But, you know, I would say it was probably more like 60% that and 40% working with the father, the partner, or, you know, kind of being the liaison between the family and the medical staff. And so, you know, there is a lot of work that's done with fathers. And so to see them really be like, sort of turned into caricatures on these shows is, you know, I feel like, again, we're setting up the role. So then men watch these shows and they think, oh, well, I don't, you know, that's how it's going to be. I'm not going to be able to help. And I think ultimately it's disempowering, you know.
Absolutely. It reminds me of my husband's opinions of the Berenstain Bears kids books. Because he used to read those and be so offended that the father was always so totally clueless idiot. And he was like, what? Who wants to have this in the children's books that you read? There isn't much of a role for it. And I don't know why that may be a complicated question, why fathers have to be look as sort of goofy. You know, maybe, again, just to make the power of the men the contrast with the men in the medical establishments right. who take care of these women in the birth. They're the doc. They're right. the men that they are really, you know, so you kind of split good father, bad father
yes.
kind of imagery there yes. where you have one father who's kind of dopey.
Yep.
The best thing he can do is eat quietly. And then you have the more heroic father, which is totally connected with the medical establishment.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I wonder if it isn't partly because the medical establishment's been beaten up quite a bit in the world today as well. So we need a moment to, you know, we need a moment to sort of re-idealize the figure of the doctor. And that maybe this show is also doing a little bit of that. Because,
well, that's
interesting. You know, everybody feels so worried about what's happening with doctors with
yeah.
the realignment of healthcare. People uh-huh. don't feel as good necessarily always about their doctors. So
sure.
they can at least say, but there's those great doctors
yeah.
doing that
yeah.
baby stuff.
Yeah, the baby stuff. Yep. Yeah, well, it's very interesting. I mean, I think the whole way that we're formulating, you know, what strikes me about this show is it's not as though what they're showing isn't actually happening. These are more or less, I mean, they're edited, mm-hmm. heavily edited, but these are more or less these people's experiences. What strikes me is that there are so many other kinds of experiences which are not represented at all.
Exactly.
And so then they disappear. They mm-hmm. become non-experiences in terms of the sort of cultural imaginary and the way that we formulate expectations.
So we see here a dichotomy between the sort of articulated cultural media model.
Yep.
And then I guess in my case it would be the personal model.
Yeah.
Because my model didn't fit any of those exactly.
Yeah.
Closest to the lucky, but not really quite in there either.
Yeah.
So we end up having, I would say, a kind of an anomalous individualized view.
Yeah.
of ourselves and our birthing experiences.
Sure.
It feels more isolated.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been different in my mother's time, for there were many other problems. I'm not saying I want to go back to, you know, South Dakota medicine in the 1920s.
Sure.
But there was a kind of lack of isolation. They
yeah.
were all in this together.
Yeah.
And there was that kind of thing. So you didn't feel... and I was quite struck. I mentioned to you also that my obstetrician said, because she never got to the hospital in time because I had my baby so fast.
Yeah.
She said if I wanted to talk about it, she would be happy to talk.
Yeah.
Because she said to me that the imagery of birth and the experience of birth stays with women throughout their whole life.
Yeah.
And so I don't see much of that being dealt with in the media
yeah.
as well, that it's something that's foundational for our psyche
right.
for many years and that we rethink an experience
oh, yeah.
for the good and the bad or whatever for many years.
Well, and you know, what's really interesting, so I think, you know, there was a movie that came out a number of years back, maybe 10 or more years ago, and it was a documentary called The Business of Being Born.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I think it's a midwife or a doula, I think it's a midwife in the show, and she says, you know, birth, and this has always stuck with me, and it's related to what you were saying, birth really isn't the time that a person needs to be saved, right? It's the time where a person comes head to head with almost their darkest moment, their moment where they feel like, okay, I don't know if I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do it. And what she says is, this is a moment at which a person can come face to face with their darkest moment. And then they can, you know, essentially be victorious, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so and it's so important to have that moment so that you can lay claim to your victory after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, what that does is really acknowledge the incredible importance of the experience. And I think that we do very little, you know, work around reflecting on what did the experience feel like? How do we feel about the images we see of our own births, of other births?
Mm-hmm.
And we do very little processing
exactly.
in the postpartum period.
It's exactly the processing point that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
In my own experience, the processing, whatever it was, I'm not sure I call it processing, was with the nurses
yeah.
who came in and told me, they were wonderful. They were fabulous nurses. But
yeah.
their main point to tell me was how it was so good to have such a quick, natural birth
yeah,
because
right.
the hospital that I was at had many difficult things.
Uh-huh.
So they were telling me this terrible story and that terrible story and then other bad things that had happened with other births.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh boy, I
yeah.
don't know whether I really want this kind of processing
yeah.
or not.
Yeah.
They were just so happy to have, uh-huh. they were so happy to have, you know, an easy birth and a baby who opened his eyes immediately
uh-huh.
and looked very interested in the world. And they kept talking about how great that was.
Uh-huh.
So we did have an odd kind of processing
yeah.
with the and actually in many ways I think that processing reflects your exact point
yeah.
because it emphasizes the mother who doesn't have trouble as the lucky one.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And so they were reiterating to me my luck as opposed to the baby before that
yeah.
You know, one different disasters that they had one way or the other. So
yeah.
so really quickly, just before we have to end today, because
sure.
we're moving along awfully fast, Why don't you tell us a little bit about, in between your work as a doula and now studying birth imagery for your PhD, you did run the Women's Center. And I'm just curious if somebody asked you sort of a very quick summary of what does the Women's Resource Center do on campus?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that that's something that very few people, who particularly people who've never walked through the door, have any idea. Why do we have a Women's Resource Center?
Yeah, those are all great questions. So, yeah, for 5 years, I was one of a core staff of four people who was, you know, working at the Women's Center. For folks who don't know, the Women's Resources and Research Center is located in North Hall on the first floor. So that's that sort of shingled building that's by the quad. It's downstairs from counseling services. And the Women's Center does a number of things. The work is generally focused around gender equity. So there's programming that happens for students, undergraduate and graduate students on campus. There's a lot of policy and administrative advocacy that happens there. So particularly looking at policies that impact women and people with marginalized gender identities. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge component of the work that's done at the Women's Center has to do with crisis work. Mm-hmm. So, and that could be for a student, a staff member, a faculty member, or a community member. And the staff at the Women's Center, both the career staff, the professional staff, and the undergraduate and graduate staff are all considered confidential resources mm-hmm. on campus, which just means that if someone wants to come in and process an experience that they've had, there are far fewer mandates to report mm-hmm. for the staff in that center mm-hmm. than there would be for any other university employee.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really important point.
Yeah.
And it's probably worth saying that a couple times on the show today, because absolutely. One of the things that's happened in our society is that there are less and less places in which confidentiality rules.
Absolutely.
That's certainly something, as somebody who's had the different kinds of training that I've had, I've become very, very aware of.
Yeah.
And while mandatory reporting is something that many people believe in,
sure.
For many reasons, it does leave the problem of people not feeling that there's some place that they can go and talk about something.
Absolutely.
So I think it's really worthwhile to really put that in everybody's head out there, that there are little bastions of confidentiality left in the world and on the UC Davis campus.
Absolutely.
And this is one of them. So somebody could go and talk about whatever it was that was bothering them.
Yep.
They said, I was listening to this radio show about birth. And it reminded me of this terrible experience I had 25 years
That's
ago when I had my babies and nobody wanted to listen to me. I tried to talk to my husband. He didn't want to hear. And I've just been thinking about this a long time.
Yeah.
So whatever it is, people can go in. So how does it work? I mean, just to give
Great
us a little
question.
Sense,
yeah.
people just walk in the door?
Yeah. So generally speaking, and I'd have to check in and see what the hours are now, but it's historically been 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. during the academic year, Monday through Friday. And someone could just walk, like you said, walk in the front door. There's a main, what we call the resource room. So it's like a main sort of lobby. And for folks who are looking to talk to someone, you would go into that main lobby room and you'd talk to whoever's at the front desk and say, hey, I'm looking for resources on sexual violence, or I'm looking to talk with someone about, you know, someone who I think might be stalking me. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking to talk with someone, then they'll go connect you with a staff member.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, people don't necessarily want to talk with anyone, but they want resources.
Right.
And so the resources are all set out in that main lobby room. Even if the Women's Center is closed for any reason, there's a whole table outside of that main resource room that has a series that we call How to Support a Friend. And there is a front and back one-page sheet on, I think, maybe nine of the most common reasons that people come into the Women's
Center. Well, again,
Center.
It's too bad that we have to emphasize this so much, and I hope we can do another show on this some other time. But there is such a mental health crisis on
Absolutely.
Campus. Anytime you open up a newspaper, people talk about how the students are, and it's way beyond us today to even begin to discuss why it is that so many undergraduates are so unhappy today. But in my mind, this is an important understood.
Yeah.
It's not understood enough resource around for the community, for students to keep in mind that there's someplace that they can go.
Yeah.
So, well, I really, really enjoyed having you on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It was very interesting.
And so that one of the things we're talking about is expanding the representations of birth by calling your mom, if you can today, our listeners, and talking with your mom about her experience bearing you, bringing you into the world.
Yeah.
So you don't only just have the images from television. As far as I could see, this show seems to be yet another good argument for my decision many years ago to never have a television in my house. So that's something I have not missed at all whatsoever. Uh-huh. And of course, as always, you can listen to this show on our archive, which is officehourucdpodcast.com. That's officehourucdpodcast.com. And it will have a link to, I think we'll put up a link this time to the Women's Resource Center.
Great.
As well as to anything that Ashley wants to put up as well. So I want to thank you very much for coming on the show, Ashley.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was great.
Yeah, and we will be back next Tuesday at 5 o'clock. We will knock on someone else's door. It'll be a completely different door. So we hope you join us then. And until then, I think thinking about birth is a good piece of homework for this week. I think there's plenty to think about and talk about birth. And we will be back next week then. Bye.